The Takeaway is supported by TechServe, equipping and supporting New York's startup business community with Mac repairs and upgrades, on-site setup and support, free seminars and events, equipment rentals, sales, consultation, and more. Studio.techserve.com. And An American in Paris, the new Tony Award-winning musical that brings the magic and romance of Paris into perfect harmony with the unforgettable songs of George and Ira Gershwin, winner of more awards than any other musical of the year. Tickets at AmericanInParisBroadway.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And, smell that. Welcome to the deli.
What makes a good deli?
Pastrami.
Very lovely chicken fat.
Soups.
Stuffed cabbage.
The smell has to hit you.
Potted meatball.
The bursting flavor.
The big sandwiches.
The pickles.
Chicken fricassee.
Giving a product that you can't get anyplace else.
You can't get this democracy special anywhere else. And the 2016 campaign is down to the delis, folks. Thanks so much to the makers of that documentary, Deli Man. Delegates, delegates, delegates. It's 20 here, a few hundred over there, a couple over there. There are just 9 contests left until we eat this presidential party convention sandwich. Pennsylvania is the big bite on the menu this week. Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton both campaigned in Philadelphia yesterday, where 189 Democratic delegates are waiting for the mustard. On the Republican side, Donald Trump and John Kasich held rallies around Philly, home of the cheesesteak, and the Democratic convention this summer. Cleveland cooks up the GOP, you'll recall. There are 71 Republican delegates at stake today. I love this part. 54 of those delegates are technically unbound, meaning they are free to go to Cleveland in July and vote any way they choose on the first and second ballot. Freedom means power. Unbound superdelegates.
I'll have what she's having.
Makes it kind of hard for the candidates. Do they campaign or just take each unbound delegate to dinner or to the deli? The Takeaway is Todd Zwillick has had some serious pastrami in his short and wonderful life, and he takes us to the political steam tables in Pennsylvania, where candidates and voters are equally confused about all this.
There's no other way to say it. It has been decades since Pennsylvania has mattered at all in a Republican primary. But this year, frontrunner Donald Trump is going down to the wire to reach 1,237 delegates by June. And for the first time in almost anyone's memory, friendly little local races to get elected delegate to the GOP convention in July are hot and full of candidates.
My name is Alex Shorb. I am chairman of the York County Republican Committee. I am in a contested race for one of the coveted unbound delegates going to the convention in Cleveland in July.
Alex Shorb is one of 15 candidates running for just 3 delegate spots in Pennsylvania's 4th congressional district. We sat down in his office in York, PA.
I want to be part of history because, you know, this could be a convention unlike anything we've seen before.
Pennsylvania Republicans have 71 delegates up for grabs today, but only 17 of those are committed to support the statewide winner on the first ballot in Cleveland. The other 54, completely unbound. Those delegates can vote any way they want, any time they want. Now, the 54 come from PA's 18 congressional districts, 3 per district. They have to run for it on the ballot today, along with the presidential candidates. Some are local officials or well-known party activists, but a lot of them aren't. Alex Shorb has pledged to support whichever candidate wins his district, at least on the first ballot in Cleveland. But that hasn't stopped the campaigns from reaching out and even making it clear that the pot can be sweetened.
You know, I did get the sense that there was money out there. You know, in the back of my mind, I said, I wonder if I could get an all-expenses-paid trip here. And I'm not sure that that would have been off the table, you know, to get that one extra delegate. Just reading between the lines and, you know, some of the people with the campaigns being clear that there is now money in Pennsylvania and they're willing to spend it.
As Election Day draws closer, the calls to potential delegates start to increase.
Come on in. He just got up.
I'll get my son out there. He's a delegate. I have a chair there in the living room.
Ed Mathias has been active in local GOP politics for years, and he's on the ballot today. He's for Ted Cruz, and we sat down in his family's living room in Camp Hill, PA, just outside Harrisburg.
I think last Thursday, right before SmackDown, yeah, it's the wrestling program that's on, it was the Cruz people. They called. No one else called. They simply suggested, would you like to jump on our flagship? And I'm like going, yeah, that sounds great.
Ed's father, George Mathias, is pro-Trump. But George has been around Pennsylvania politics long enough to know that a vote for his son, who's pro-Cruz, could hurt Donald Trump, even if he wins statewide.
He's got the petition signed. I signed for him. But I will not vote for him since he's going to vote for Cruz. When he tells me he's going to vote for Cruz, I said, no, I'll vote for Trump, and I won't vote for him.
How's that go down?
He doesn't like it.
I don't like it, but that's the thing about America. You know, he can vote for whoever he wants. I just think he's making a big mistake.
Now, it sounds strange, but in some ways, George Mathias actually has it easy. He knows Ed is pro-Cruz, so even at the risk of a little household conflict, he knows not to vote for his own son, not in Pennsylvania. But here's another problem. No one else might know that. Some candidates like Ed are declared for Trump or for Cruz. Not that many, as it happens, are declared for John Kasich. Some say they'll support whichever candidate wins their congressional district. But still others make no promises at all. And the ballot today just lists a bunch of delegate names with no information on who they support or would be willing to support in Cleveland.
What's even more confusing is that the delegates who will be on the ballot when the voters go in the booth, they won't even know who they're supporting.
That's Lou Barletta. He's a Republican congressman. He represents the 11th district right next door to the 4th. Barletta has endorsed Donald Trump, but he's not running for delegate himself.
Theoretically, someone could go in there supporting Donald Trump and voting for Donald Trump and then picking three people names on as a delegate and actually give three votes to Ted Cruz and actually cost Donald Trump delegates by doing that. Many may actually go in there and negate their own vote and not even realize they did it.
It's a major issue for the presidential campaigns. Not only do you have to try to recruit delegates to your side, you have to make sure that the voters know that it's not enough in the Pennsylvania GOP to just vote for the presidential candidate you like. Mark Scarleggi is running for delegate in the 4th district outside of Harrisburg on a Trump-only slate. He says he was shocked by a conversation he had with a longtime GOP activist who he assumed was up on the rules.
This is a little troubling to me that we're this close now to primary election day, and this is a Republican, a lifelong Republican, who's not quite aware of how it works to of how you get your particular candidate, in this case Donald Trump, nominated at the convention. Well, she was thinking that it's just the popular vote that gets the job done, and that's just not the way it works in Pennsylvania.
Lee Snover is another pro-Trump delegate running in the 17th district in eastern PA. She told me that PACs supporting John Kasich put out 8 robocalls for their delegate in her area. Cruz forces did 1, and Trump, 0. So if you're running for delegate today and you can't rely on the big boys necessarily to advertise for you, what can you do to stand out? In a delegate race, most voters are used to ignoring anyway. One way is traditional, just be well known. And it's how longtime GOP operative Charlie Giroux is hoping to win. Drive around the York and Harrisburg area, you see Charlie Giroux signs everywhere.
I think we bought 400, but that in and of itself should tell you something, because you shouldn't have to buy 300 signs to run for delegate. It's really embarrassing in some respects, but you have to do what you have to do. I want to go to Cleveland as a delegate, and so I'm out there making my pitch to the voters.
Andrew Ritter is another 4th district contender unpledged to any candidate, and he's done what few other candidates have. He's raised money for this.
I've raised over $5,000. It's nothing to sneeze at, and we'll be using every penny of that and more.
Ritter is using traditional direct mail to get his name out to voters.
I have some of my poll cards here, which our volunteers will be handing out on election day. We'll have at least the top 20 largest polling places covered in the district, so we'll be handing those out.
Those poll cards are actually huge in this race. All the campaigns, including Trump's, are using them. Since voters probably don't know which delegate is for which candidate, you park your supporters outside the polls today and hand out cheat sheets to voters on the way in to vote. Make sure they know if you want candidate W, you have to vote for delegate X, Y, and Z. But candidate after candidate says if the presidential campaigns had been on the ground earlier in Pennsylvania, they wouldn't be struggling with a bunch of confusion. Plus, there's a secret weapon in this race, and it's not Trump's or Cruz's. Those 17 delegates we mentioned at the beginning, the ones who are bound to support whoever wins statewide in Pennsylvania, that's only on the first ballot. Most of them are state GOP officials, and they are widely known to be behind John Kasich. And that means that if Trump falls just short of 1,237, he could look back on Pennsylvania as one gigantic missed opportunity. Charlie Giroux.
Pennsylvania, if we get to a contested convention, will be at the center of every conversation, every negotiation, every scenario that you can possibly imagine.
And whoever's declared the winner in Pennsylvania tonight will have only done a fraction of the job it actually takes to get Pennsylvania in your corner. For The Takeaway, this is Todd Zwillick. At the love, delicatessen.
Nothing like a good deli. Any delegates out there, former or current, who would care to explain all of this? You know how to reach us, 877-8-MY-TAKE. What do delegates do? Later this hour, the delegate wisdom of a woman who knows the tortured history of political conventions and how it's about to get twisted once again this summer.
We can count them, but I have been to every Republican convention from 1952 through 1996, except 1984, because Ronald Reagan was going to win big, and Ronald Reagan's was against the ERA, was against a woman's right to choose, and I saw no reason to go and fight the battle.
Meet Tanya Milich, whose recollection of the contested GOP convention in 1976 reminds us how the battle between traditional and angry conservatives framed the historic convention fight between incumbent President Gerald Ford and challenger Ronald Reagan. Here's the voice of the mainstream just before he was swept away, Vice President Nelson Rockefeller, whose millions would be billions today, by the way.
Frankly, this Republican Party of ours has been shrinking, not growing, and it's time to face up to this reality.
That's Vice President Nelson Rockefeller speaking from the convention floor in Kansas City, a city with some celebrated delis of its own. Tanya Milich reminds us what it was like to be fought over as a delegate, and in her case, fought over as one of the relatively few feminist Republicans, which makes her story even more interesting.
The general public does not control conventions. It's not like a general election. So when the Rules and Credentials and Platform Committee members meet, and they meet generally the week before the convention opens, the people, particularly on the Rules Committee, can determine what the rules will be.
So how do you wheel and deal for delegates? What do you do? I mean, with all the money in campaigns these days, I can just imagine people writing giant checks. Is it illegal to take a delegate to dinner? And
No. If you're for one of the campaigns and I'm a delegate,
right,
you can invite me to dinner. That's okay.
More with Tanya Milich later this hour. Just keep listening.
The Takeaway is supported by TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is committed to helping those who do good do well. Learn more at TIAA.org. And Staples, offering tools for small business, including color copies and presentations, booklets and manuals, and custom frame prints and posters. Designed and printed in-store or ordered online at Staples.com. Staples, make more happen.
Does knowing something mean you actually know something? Couples looking forward to having a baby can, at just 10 weeks into pregnancy, have a routine blood test that can tell if a fetus is a boy or a girl and if the fetus is at risk for complications, a whole range of complications. Lee Herzenberg did not have the option of a test back in 1961 when she and her husband grappled with the unexpected after the birth of her son.
The baby was lost. This, you know, we hugged each other, and it was, you know, a terrible conversation to realize that you'd lost the baby. There wasn't this question of what if or whatever. It just, this was what happened. And so, but, you know, we knew immediately what we would do. We had already made the decision that this was not a good thing to take the baby home. And so we didn't.
Lee and her husband, parent of a Down syndrome son, they gave up that son at birth, started to advocate for a better prenatal blood test in the late 1970s. And you can hear her story this week on Only Human, a health podcast from WNYC Studios. Mary Harris is Only Human's host and managing editor. She joins me now. Mary, welcome back to The Takeaway.
Great to see you.
The range of tests that's available to you that suggests to new parents that you can know the future is something that was unheard of even 40 years ago, right?
Well, the weird thing to me is that 8 years ago, I had my first kid, and the prenatal testing seemed like witchcraft to me. It was like a couple blood tests, and then we're going to measure the neck. I was given this odds ratio, like you have a one in whatever chance of Down syndrome. Now, at 10 weeks, you get this blood test, and it tells you very accurately not just risk of Down syndrome, but the child's gender. And now they're screening across the genome for all kinds of chromosomal abnormalities, and you kind of don't know what you're going to find or really what it means.
What is the total range of possibilities that they can screen for in this new test, this blood test?
Well, so now there's a test where they literally look at all of the genetic information. So here's a good example, chromosome 16. It's incompatible with life. So if you are screening positive for chromosome 16, it means probably you're going to miscarry the pregnancy. But there's mosaic chromosome 16 or abnormalities where there's problems in some cells and not others. And that can have a screen positive too. And then you really don't know what it means. 20% of those kids are fine. Some of them are a little bit small. Some of them need a lot more care.
So the experience of Lee Herzenberg that we played at the top of this segment, talking about her lost baby and maybe having a decision, having more information would have helped, is sort of correct, maybe not correct.
No, I mean, it is correct. She would have made a different decision if she knew. But that's a really personal thing. What's interesting to me is now this test is a reality. And Lee Herzenberg says, you know, I think it's wonderful that women can screen for Down syndrome, but I hate that they can screen for gender because that means you could abort for gender.
Here's Dr. Diana Bianchi talking about the Herzenberg experience and also just the ubiquity of these tests.
At the end of the day, it's hard to think of another test that's used in medicine that has been incorporated so rapidly into care and has totally transformed prenatal screening and diagnosis worldwide.
And this transformation, as you note, so it's bad to screen for gender, but it's okay to screen for Downs. Why is that the case? I mean, why is it any better to screen for Downs? There are plenty of perfectly wonderful families with Down syndrome kids all over the world today. And if you had asked any of them if they would have preferred that the kid had not been born, they not only would they be insulted and angry at you, but they would be heartbroken.
Well, here's the interesting thing to me. Diana Bianchi, who we just heard from there, she was really there at the beginning. She was there when this test was sort of just a notion. And she's followed it through. It's become her life's work. Now her work is to try to treat Down syndrome in the womb. So she's trying to flip the script here. Right now, what people talk about is you get this test and it gives you the ability to decide whether you're going to continue the pregnancy or end it, right? And she's saying, I want to do something different. She's saying, I want to give parents the opportunity not just to prepare for a child with Down syndrome, but I want to potentially treat them in utero because you get your results at 10 weeks. You know, you might have a kid with Down syndrome. A lot of people in America choose to keep those babies. In the UK, it's very different. But in the United States, 44% of parents choose to keep a pregnancy with Down syndrome.
And there are people who say that to not view a Down syndrome child as normal constitutes a controversial sort of approach to human beings. I mean, here's Kurt Kondrick.
By not giving the facts out about these children, what we've done is it's silent eugenics because you're identifying, targeting, eliminating a group of people based on misinformation and based on what you perceive as a mandated perfection.
Mandated perfection. Let's explore that a little bit. When a couple goes in and has this test, are they told your child is presumed to be perfect unless Down syndrome, this is not perfect, this is not normal?
What people are told when they get these tests is really varying. These tests are rolled out so quickly. They've just been available over the last 5 years, and you just get them at your OBGYN's office. So you get a really wide variety of information. Now, Kurt Kondrick, he has a daughter with Down syndrome. She's 13. She's reading at grade level. She's really benefited from early intervention programs, and he really wanted to change how people thought of this diagnosis. So he passed a law in Pennsylvania that actually mandates the kind of information you get when you get get these test results. And it's all about the early intervention system and what kind of services are available to you. And it's not about abortion, because he wanted to just change how people thought of this diagnosis.
Has this conflated itself into the whole abortion debate, where certain families, couples, would feel there's an element of choice that comes with this test and the information associated with this test that is equivalent in some way to the choice that we associate with the abortion debate?
We really have to tease apart the abortion debate and the diagnosis debate, because they don't mean the same thing. A diagnosis doesn't mean something's wrong with your kid. One of the things that Kurt Kondrick said was, we're all like one car accident away, one horrible event away from being a disabled person. And if you live long enough, someone's going to change your diapers. So it's like we're all going to be down this road, and we need to start thinking about how we care for the people in our lives. I thought that was a really interesting point.
Before we go, what do your listeners and your podcast users say about an issue like this in a country where it's legal to abort, but yet there are controversies associated with other choices that are made in utero? How does that work?
So I really want to know what people think about this, because I think this is a debate we need to be having in this country. So I would love it if people went to onlyhuman.org and told us what they thought about this, because this is a brand new test and it's raising a lot of really important questions.
Mary Harris is host and managing editor of Only Human, WNYC Studios health program. You can hear more about the blood test for Down syndrome on today's episode. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry, and there is primary voting in Maryland, Connecticut, Rhode Island, Delaware, and Pennsylvania today. And we got some serious work to do on our takeaway demographic. I mean, we asked to hear from voters in all those states, Democrats and Republicans, and we got...
This is Kevin from Norwalk, Connecticut. I'm voting for Hillary Clinton. I choose rational sanity. I don't know where you live, but my country isn't broken.
I'm Amy from Johnston, Rhode Island. And I am thrilled to vote in the Democratic primaries in Rhode Island for Bernie Sanders.
Amy and Kevin, and thank you, Amy and Kevin, represent geographic diversity in our public radio digital live stream audience sample. Party diversity? Not so much. Let's spin the wheel.
My name's Ray from the great state of Delaware. And I got to say, I'm probably going to vote for Mrs. Clinton. I think it's time that we give a woman a chance as President of the United States. Regardless of all of her faults, I think she's overqualified for the position.
My name is Susan Wright, and I'm calling from West Warwick, Rhode Island. I am definitely going to be voting. My spouse and our two youngest kids have a date to go to our polling place together after we all get out of work. We'll be casting our votes for Bernie. It bothers me when people say, I agree more with Bernie, but he's too idealistic. How will we ever get to a better place if we don't say what we want with our votes?
Medville, Pennsylvania. I'm a Democratic insider who will be voting for Sanders. I have a feeling I'll date Bernie and marry Hillary. Thank you, Medville. Okay, I'm going to spin the wheel again. GOP, 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 GOP. Come on.
This is Lloyd from Baltimore. I am voting for Hillary Rodham Clinton because she is the only person running who can do a great job as President of the United States.
Skunked again. Now look, our surveys show that people on both sides of the aisle listen to us, so spin the wheel.
My name is Michael Shaw. I'm calling from Pennsylvania. I'm not voting in the primaries because I can't vote. I'm an independent, and Pennsylvania's antiquated system of not allowing independents to vote in the primaries has shut me out. But if I do vote in the general election, I certainly will vote for Bernie Sanders. Bernie Sanders is the only candidate that I feel has any credibility left at all, and he is certainly a leader that will support many causes of which I am in support, including the banning of fracking in Pennsylvania.
This is Elise from Harleysville, Pennsylvania. Yes, I'm voting in the primary. Yes, I'm voting for Bernie because I'm a proud idealist, independent, and anti-establishment person. And in case Bernie loses, I will then be fine voting for Hillary. The baloney that the Dems are divided is just that. Fodder for the media. No offense, guys.
This is Monica from Rhode Island, and I'll be voting for Hillary Clinton. She is the smartest and most experienced of them all, and it's about time that a woman is president.
Man, here's Rich from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Hillary, read through Bernie's website, and I just don't see his proposals making it through Congress, and he's too worried about a revolution. Okay, I get it. Next spin, $5 on Democrat.
This is Elise Schubert. I'm calling from Wilmington, Delaware. I am absolutely going to vote in the primary on Tuesday before work because I think it's all of our duty to do research and participate in the process. I'm going to vote for Bernie because I feel he's the only candidate that I can trust and because I think the redistribution of wealth and income inequality is one of the biggest issues that our country is facing right now.
All right. And our one GOP voter out of all of you came from Ambler, Pennsylvania, Governor Kasich. Not impressed by the other two, and I think he can beat Senator Clinton, who would be a disaster for the country. Kasich, as one of the other candidates would say, I could shoot an arrow down Fifth Avenue and not hit a Kasich voter. You know what I mean? Are you voting in the primary today? Tell us who you're voting for and why. 877-8-MY-TAKE is our number, and you can always comment at thetakeaway.org. And we leave you this hour with a political activist who shares a lifetime of wisdom with us. Political analyst Tanya Milich was there at the GOP convention in 1952 and was there every 4 years with one exception until 1996 when she left the GOP to co-found the National Women's Political Caucus and write a political classic, The Republican War Against Women, an insider's report from behind the lines. Milich was a delegate, a Republican activist, and a passionate feminist. 1976 was the last contested GOP convention, and she was there when rising star Ronald Reagan squared off against President Gerald Ford in Kansas City.
Mrs. Ford is arriving at the instant that the Reagans have arrived on the other side. The Reagans are inside the auditorium. The band has started to play, and there you see Mrs. Ford and her sons on the way inside.
In the end, the only thing Gerald Ford had going for him was the fact that he was the incumbent president. Ford held off the Reagan challenge.
Delegates and alternates to this Republican convention, I am honored by your nomination, and I accept it.
Tanya Milich says there is still a lot to be learned from the nomination battles, and she can't wait to see what happens this summer in Cleveland and Philadelphia to see if it rivals the drama of Kansas City.
The dynamic at the 76 convention was really about whether or not you were going to throw out a sitting president. That's what it was about. And it doesn't compare with what our situation now, because Gerald Ford, as the president, had an enormous power and influence among a lot of Republicans, including those Goldwater people who were Southern and Western people.
But he wasn't elected. He only took over because Nixon resigned. So he didn't have an electoral mandate behind him. And
that's
correct. The argument.
That's the argument. But when you are the president of the United States, you have prestige and respect. And before the convention, delegates were invited to meet Betty Ford, to meet the family. The monkey wrench in all of this is, of course, when Ford pardoned Nixon. If Ford hadn't pardoned Nixon, given the closeness of that election, 76, Ford might have won.
Hmm. Who's running the show if it's a contested convention?
The advantages are twofold. One is that the head of the RNC, Rice Priebus, from Wisconsin, same place as Paul Ryan. The Wisconsin Republicans are very powerful. The people who are in charge of who gets the tickets, what kind of room you get to hold your rallies in, hotel rooms, are you way out 15 miles away from the convention center? All of those logistics things are controlled through the Republican National Committee.
So how does someone get delegates that they don't have committed? Do you just schmooze them? Do you?
You schmooze them. You do the kind of things that Americans have been doing from the beginning of our country. If you do as Cruz has done, and I think what Walker tried to do at the beginning, and Jeb Bush's people, you call up the people you know and you talk to them. You have a beer. You invite them to a party. You go to their children's little league game. Again, what's important here is this is not a general election fight. This is a fight within a political party.
So there's no rules, really. Compare this coming convention to what you've already seen. This seems more chaotic than anything I can remember.
When I decided to write a piece about this, I went back and I read through the contested conventions of the Republican Party. And there are a couple that stand out. The first one is 1912. Anybody who really wants to have an exciting read for an evening, go back and read about William Howard Taft and Teddy Roosevelt.
Are the American people fit to govern themselves, to rule themselves, to control themselves? I believe they are. My opponents do not.
May we not hope that the great majority of voters will be able to distinguish between the substance of performance and the question of prompt?
I can't tell you if it's as chaotic as what we have, but the fight was over. Guess what? Delegates and how these delegates were going to be selected in, as usual, the southern states. And it was over representation of blacks. And the numbers were such that Teddy finally walked out. Now, you could have a situation where Trump walks out. The difference between the 1912 and this present situation is that William Howard Taft and Teddy Roosevelt were together. They were both Republicans. They had been active for many, many years in the party. So then we move up to 1952. Again, you have Taft and Eisenhower, not outsiders. The fight is enormous. Maybe not as chaotic, but that's probably because we have the net and all this communication. And then you had uncommitteds, and this is the other thing we need to watch, our governors. Harold Stassen in Minnesota was a favorite son, kind of like we could say Kasich was in Ohio.
Mr. Chairman,
gentlemen,
Minnesota wishes to change its vote to Eisenhower.
Earl Warren in California, he was holding his delegates. Governor McKellen in Maryland. So they went to this convention in 52. Taft was ahead. Taft controlled what was thought to be the mechanism, like I said, Rice Priebus does, except they were 70 short, Taft was. And I think of all the contested conventions that you can look at in the Republican Party, it is the 52 convention that will give us the most guidance, because this is the convention where the fight was again over rules.
So by 1980, it's Reagan. And really, the party has held together until now. What do you think is breaking up? What do you think is falling apart here?
Well, first of all, I left the party.
Right.
And a lot of my friends left the party. Most of us left in 96 with Bill Clinton the second time around. The African Americans began to leave with FDR. Then Pete Wilson, who was the governor of California, made some statements that led to the Hispanics in California leaving. This is all in the 90s. So the party was disintegrating into a party that was essentially made up of white people.
Right.
I mean, yes, they're the tokens, but this is what happened. So I think you have the natural change that's happening now. And then you had the recession, 2008. So the idea that the party is imploding now is not quite true. The party began to implode when they rejected people like me and then the other groups that I talked about.
You going to go anywhere near Cleveland?
Oh, I would love to go. My group of Republican feminists, and they're all mostly in the Democratic Party, or one or two. I have one friend in Southern California who is still in the Republican Party. We would all love to go, but not to participate, but to watch.
Just to watch. Tanya Milich has attended every Republican convention from 1952 through 1996, with the exception of 1984. She was at the last contested Republican convention back in 1976. Tanya, thanks so much.
Thank you. I enjoyed speaking with you, John.
Great. And here's something to take with you today. Art conquers fear and teaches us something about memory on this 30th anniversary of the Chernobyl nuclear disaster. Brisbane, Australian visual artist Guido Van Helton went inside abandoned reactor number 5 on the Chernobyl site in Ukraine for 6 hours to spray a haunting mural depicting the face of a doctor from a celebrated news photo taken shortly after the meltdown disaster that killed 31 people. Van Helton says he risked radiation contamination in painting the mural, which he says is an artistic reminder of the risks of nuclear energy. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by Virtusa Polaris, a global service provider of IT consulting, technology, and outsourcing services, working to help financial services firms become market leaders. VirtusaPolaris.com. Staples, offering tools for small business, including color copies and presentations, booklets and manuals, and custom frame prints and posters. Designed and printed in-store or ordered online at Staples.com. Staples, make more happen. From Lumosity, offering a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving. With brain games to calculate baseline scores and build a brain training program, performance can be compared with global averages. Learn more at Lumosity.com. The Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at the New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.